Much of this happened under cover of the heavy clouds that almost always blanketed this part of the world, and so if anyone was watching them, it had to be directly, by actually following them around, or with flying robots. But now they had flying robots of their own that could alert them to the presence of both. Since those remained quiet, they felt reasonably certain that they were not being tracked, except by large canids, who tended to make their presence obvious by howling a lot. Because of them, the next night was a restless one, and led to an early departure and a final day of hiking that rapidly developed into a pell-mell descent out of the alpine zone and toward the Pacific. During their lunch break, they spied a trio of single-person gliders, inflatables like the one Cath 2 had taken on her survey mission, dipping and darting along the coast from the general direction of Kayak. As these carried blue markings and were transmitting blue codes, Bellet felt comfortable divulging their position. Minutes later, the gliders had touched down in an expanse of heather a few hundred meters below them. Their occupants climbed out, eviscerated their cargo holds, and began to deflate their gliders so that they could be rolled up. Most of that work ended up being done by a Teklin, shorter and more lithe than Bellet. This left the other two new arrivals free to approach. One of them was a Kamite, whose gait and posture were more expressive of male than of female characteristics, and so Ty made a mental note to employ male pronouns until and unless the Kamite requested otherwise. He wore one of the utilitarian coveralls employed by survey personnel, with red cross patches on the chest and shoulder, marking him as a medic. The other was a middle-aged Ivan, dressed in civilian clothes, marginally more posh than might be expected in the wilderness of Beringia, but suited to the conditions. Regarding them from a more sheltered position overlooking the meadow, Ty had mixed feelings. Any assistance was, of course, welcome. He had known better than to expect a thunderous show of force. Blue's high political councils, having been caught badly off guard and having lost the first round to their red counterparts, would be assessing the situation and thinking about their options. For public consumption, they were probably characterizing the Seven as a plain vanilla survey team that had fallen victim to an ambush. They didn't want to undercut that story now by sending in an undeniably military force. The name printed on the Kamite's uniform was Hope, which probably meant that, like many Kamites, he only used one name. Bent under a medical pack, he went directly to Cath. Bellet and Bard were descending to the meadow to help the Teklin pack up the gliders. The Ivan singled out Ty from a distance and approached him. The family name on his uniform was Issa, and he introduced himself as Arjun. The former was an acronym frequently seen in the background of shots in the epic, standing for European Space Agency. It had become a common name. Ty considered asking Arjun flat out who he was and what he did for a living that caused him to show up in circumstances like these, but he knew it would get him nowhere. The man would have some bland answer queued up. He was probably some kind of high-powered intelligence analyst with 5 advanced degrees.
"How's all this playing up on the ring?" Ty asked him. "Do I even want to know?"
The mere question caused Arjun to break eye contact and gaze out over the sea.
"That bad?" Ty prompted him.
"You know the Arataics," Arjun said.
"They made it into grand opera, eh?"
"That's as good a description as any. I'm still coming to grips with it. Of course, we rarely see content from the red side of the ring."
"Just the propaganda," Ty said.
"Yes, and when we see that, we have a laugh at the overwrought style, the Baroque production values, while harboring an inner sense of anxiety that some people within Blue might
actually believe their shit."
"Exactly."
"So Red did broadcast it?"
Arjun nodded.
"Live, to the whole ring." "Sorry I missed the show. We bolted before the actual contact. It seemed like as good a time as any."
"That was a fine tactic," Arjun replied, "and saved you a great deal of annoyance."
"How do you mean?"
Arjun turned to look directly at him.
"The diggers," he said, "were as receptive to Red's overtures as they were hostile to yours."
Ty felt something in his chest.
the awareness that he had failed, and that people knew it. It was not a feeling to which he was accustomed, and he did not like it.
"So," he said, "the diggers ate it up?"
"They signed an alliance with Red on the spot. Red recognized their claim to the entire land surface of Earth and urged Blue to follow suit."
"Just as a matter of basic human decency," Ty said sourly.
"Of course. The saber rattling began the next day." Issa Arjun broke off as he noticed and focused on Sonar Taxlaw, who was standing next to Einstein, who was telling her how the gliders worked. Ty had grown used to it. All those two did the whole time they were awake was explain things to each other. But it was new to Arjun.
"She's the..." Arjun said, and trailed off.
Ty tried to put himself in Arjun's shoes, laying eyes on a rootstock human for the first time in his life, seeing someone who was clearly human and yet not of any identifiable human race, thinking about all that her ancestors had lived through.
"Yeah," Ty said.
Arjun managed to snap out of his reverie and looked back at Ty. "The narrative being put out is that you abducted her."
"Of course."
Einstein said something funny. The psych laughed and leaned into him affectionately. His arm found its way around her waist, the hand sliding down to the hip.
"Are those two..." Arjun began.
"Fucking? Not yet. But only because we've been on the run."
"The diggers, from what intelligence we've been able to scrape together, believe in strict gender roles, and..."
"Not fucking, yeah. I'll talk to Einstein. Tell him not to fuck her."
"But you didn't..."
"Abduct her? No, she just tagged along."
Sensing doubt, or at least curiosity from the Ivan, Ty continued,
"And more would do given the same chance. The transition to surface life is putting their culture through a blender, which is why their leaders are being so reactionary."
Arjun nodded. "And how's your Moiraine?"
Ty sighed. "She saw Doc and Memmi die and suffered a blunt force trauma to her arm and was forced to draw her cat and to use it. As soon as it happened, she went into what I'm guessing is a classic potesh."
This was military jargon for post-traumatic epigenetic shift.
"That is confirmed," said Hope, who seemed to have finished an initial scan of Kath's vital signs. "Higher metabolism and hyperacute senses are observable. Her microbiome is a mess. I'm tuning it up with probiotic supplements that'll be a better fit with her new phenotype. Suggested by the nausea are big hormone shifts, possibly predictive of some future..."
"Testosterone poisoning?"
Ty suggested, finishing Hope's thought. Hope responded with a diffident nod of the head. Ty turned his attention back to Arjun.
"So 3 billion people just learned that the diggers exist. How are they taking it?"
"Well, obviously it is a sensational bit of news," Arjun said. "People are intensely curious."
He turned his head again to study Sonar Taxlaw.
"As am I admit it."
"Does the general public know how badly the first contact went wrong?" Ty asked.
"None of the identities of your 7 are public knowledge. Certainly no one has the faintest idea that who Noah had anything to do with it."
"So Red hasn't been trumpeting that."
"It wouldn't be to Red's advantage, as I see it," Arjun said. "Now that they are allied with the diggers, they want to make the diggers out to be sympathetic. Revealing that they killed Hu Noah and his nurse would hardly serve that end."
"So we are just being made out to be some sort of anonymous thug squad. The diggers chased us off with help from Red. We abducted a hostage as we were running away."
Arjun looked him in the eye. "No intelligent person in Blue believes that, of course."
"But Blue hasn't put out a countervailing narrative yet, either."
"It isn't Blue's strong suit," Arjun sighed. "Never has been, right? We're technocrats. We make decisions like engineers, which doesn't always line up with what people imagine they want."
"Are you speaking of Blue in general?" Ty asked. "Or Rio in particular?"
using the name of the Ivan Central Habitat as synecdoche for its culture. Both, a blue mentality that places us at the top of the decision-making pyramid. There's a reason why the very few Aiedans who have become prominent in blue have been musicians, actors, artists.
They're supplying something our culture lacks, Ty said.
You were supposed to supply it, Arjun said, meaning, as Ty understood, the Dainin race. And you did, during the heroic age. Ty could feel a not altogether cheerful smile on his face.
By actually doing things, you mean, he said, as opposed to pretending to do them in made-up entertainment programs.
You know what, though? It's all entertainment, real or made up. It's stuff that people watch on screens or VARPs. Red gets that.
Well, Ty said, maybe we can continue the discussion in my bar if we get out of this. But the bottom line for now, if I'm hearing you right, is that, narrative-wise, Red is killing us.
We have been a little distracted, Arjun said, showing a bit of defensiveness for the first time.
By what Red did, you mean, Ty said.
He was referring to the insertion of the Peloton, Marge's glorious return, and the lovey-dovey stuff between their delegation and the Diggers. Arjun did not out-and-out disagree, but the look on his face was a bit impatient, the smart teacher working with a slow pupil. More by what they've been doing, for a while now.
Well, Ty said, as a mere bartender, I wouldn't know about anything other than what is on the news feeds. So tell me, what have they been doing?
What do you know about the Kulak?
What any civilian lacking a security clearance would know, Ty answered carefully. People are assumed to be living in the fist part of it.
Kulak was Russian for fist. In this context, it denoted an irregular lump of nickel iron some 30 kilometers across. 150 years ago, Red had moved it from the Kamchatka boneyard to a position above the Makassar Strait, where it had orbited ever since. Like a loosely clenched fist, it had a cavity down the middle, a tunnel now presumed to be lined with rotating habitats. Red's answer to the Great Chain.
Then there's the rigging and spars whatnot surrounding that, Ty went on.
For the fist, viewed from a distance, seemed to be tangled in a sparse web of cables, like a seed in a spider web. Above and below, to the nadir and zenith sides, these converged on hard points to which the long cables extending down to Earth's surface and up to the counterweight, the anti-Makassar, were attached. Sonar tax law, a few meters away, had been engaged in a public display of affection with Einstein, but withdrew slightly and turned her head to listen. Ty had grown accustomed to her ways. It was because he had said spars. That was between sonar and tax law in the Encyclopedia Britannica, and thus belonged to her domain of knowledge. During their hike over the mountains and down the other side, she had turned out to be well-informed, at least by troglodyte standards, about space exploration and the sun. So it had been easy to bring her up to speed on the last 5,000 years off-planet developments. She now began to drift toward Ty. Einstein followed her, as if his eyes were connected to her butt cheeks with fishhooks. Oblivious to all of this, for he had his back to it, Arjun was regarding him coolly, expecting more. Ty went on.
The part on the surface, their answer to Cradle, we don't know much about. They've been building it under the sea.
They call it the Gnomon, Arjun informed him. Then he spelled the word out.
What does it mean?
It used to be the thing that stood up in the middle of a sundial to cast the shadow, aligned with the Earth's axis. Ty considered it.
Interesting choice of words.
It's big, Ty, much bigger than Cradle. There's a reason they've been building it in the ocean, partly to hide it from us, and partly because it's too large to construct on terra firma.
How big are we talking about, exactly?
There is only so much I'm at liberty to say, Arjun said. Then he drew out a tablet and began tapping at it, pulling up a world map, panning and zooming toward the mess of islands between Southeast Asia and Australia.
But just look at this and tell me what you see. He handed it to Ty.
Southeast Asia! Exclaimed the psych, who had drawn close enough to see all of this over Arjun's shoulder. Is there anything you would care to know of it? Or of Sulawesi? Or of Sri Lanka?
The Ivan regarded her with fascination.
I don't need to look, Ty said. I know what's there. The equator runs through all of that and rarely crosses over the land, and Red never stops whining about it.
Not true. Sumatra, said the psych.
A big island, to be sure, Ty said, but not a continent. Do you remember, Sonar, what I told you about how the eye works? What Cradle does?
Touches the equator, she returned.
And only the equator, which is great if you control Africa and South America, which Blue does, but most of Red's territory lies north or south of the line.
Sonar wasn't going to be talked down so easily.
Singapore is close, she said, and that is connected to Asia.
The former location of Singapore is close, yes, but not on the equator. It's 1 or 2 degrees north. Cradle can't dock there.
And that one detail, more than anything else, is what infuriated the Aiedans about the design of the eye and cradle, Arjun put in. Sensing Einstein behind her, the psych leaned comfortably back against him and started rattling off facts, her default mode of social interaction.
Aiedans, she said, the ABC hierarchy. Aratheks, Betas, Kamites.
Kamites are a different race, Einstein reminded her.
Oh, yeah. The relationship of the A and the B to the C is more akin to symbiosis.
Ty and Einstein exchanged a wry look. Oblivious, Sonar Taxlaw gazed down the hill toward Langobard.
Neoanders, and two more, the smart ones and the crazy ones.
Jinns and Ekstats, Einstein said. They don't get out much. Arjun's fascination with seeing a rootstock human had given way to impatience. He focused on Ty again.
This is old history, of course, he said, but never forgotten by some people. Way back when the eye was being designed, I'm talking 1,000 years ago, there were alternative schemes proposed. The one we ended up with was simplest, easiest to build with what people had back then. The eye, the big rock, and a small cradle with sockets on the equator. Great for access to South America and Africa. Almost useless, however, in the stretch of the equator under the habitats where Aiedans, half of the Kamites, and most of the Julians lived.
What later became Red, Einstein put in, for Sonar Taxlaw's benefit. One of the reasons Red later coalesced and built such a strong counter-identity to Blue was their sense of grievance over this decision. We should have waited, they said. We could have had something much more useful than Cradle. Arjun zoomed in on Indonesia and dragged out a skinny rectangle, straddling the equator and spanning most of Red's latitudes. If instead of Cradle, we had made something in the shape of a long arc, spanning a greater distance north-south, it might have connected with Asia down here, where Singapore used to be. And here, it could touch the northern Cape of New Guinea. And New Guinea could be connected to Australia by dropping enough rocks into the shallows between them.
A long arc, aligned with the Earth's axis, casting a shadow on the ground, Ty said, nodding. A gnomon.
It would have to be huge, Einstein exclaimed.
Arjun nodded. Plans for it were drawn up, studies commissioned on how it might be constructed, in orbit or on the surface. It was deemed too ambitious. So wiser heads prevailed, said Arjun. Or so it seemed at the time, and we built what we built. We can always make something bigger later, they said. But it didn't turn out that way. Blue forgot about it. Red didn't. Their Jinns put as much effort into thinking about it as our Ivans put into epigenetics. As soon as they closed the border and put up the 2 turnpikes, they went to work.
What have they been doing that whole time?
Smiting the Torres Strait with an unceasing storm of bolides, said Sonar Taxlaw, pointing to the narrows where Australia's northern cape almost poked New Guinea in the belly.
filling it in, damming the currents, making a wall against those that swim in the sea.
Arjun nodded. Then his head snapped around to focus on the psych. He stared at her intently for a moment, then looked at Tai.
Did you... he began.
Not a word, Tai said.
Einstein, did you tell her about Red's illegal terraforming operation here?
And he tapped the same place on the map.
First I've heard of it, Einstein said.
Sonar, Arjun said. How did you know about that?
The pingers told us, Sonar said.
Who the hell are the pingers?
The people we are going to talk to,
Sonar said. Bellet and Bard had been assisting the Teclan. Those three now approached, carrying the glider packs. They set them down and began camouflaging them under such foliage as was available in this place. Scrubby bushes that had been socked into the brow of the slope to stabilize it and provide refuge for small animals. Tai got the feeling, from clues in the Teclan's physique and general style of movement, that he was some manner of snake-eater. When it became evident to the Teclan that the two larger men were better than he was at uprooting plants and moving dirt, this man left them to finish the task and approached. Tucked under his left arm was a container matching the general size and shape of those still used, in Chainhattan, to transport pizza. Dangling from that hand was a roughly cubical equipment case. With his free right hand, he exchanged salutes with Tai and identified himself as one Roscos Yur. He then set the two parcels in front of Tai and backed away from them.
Thank you, Tai said.
You're welcome, sir.
Why, Arjun asked, did you want those? Do you have any idea what it costs to get them here?
This psych can explain along the way, Tai said.
Arjun held his gaze on Tai for a moment, then glanced away with a diffident nod. Roscos Yur, by contrast, looked hard at him and wouldn't stop looking. After a few moments of this, Tai felt obliged to meet the Teclan's eye. Now that Tai could scan this man's insignia more carefully, he could see that he was part of a unit stationed at Nunavak, one of the forward blue outposts right up against the border. It was a byword for remote and isolated. It made Kayak seem like a metropolis, full of snake-eaters always being sent off on crazy missions.
That's not really what he's asking, sir, said Roscos Yur. He's really asking, who the fuck are you?
Sergeant Major Yur, Arjun said in a tone of protest. But Yur would not be stopped.
And don't tell us you're a bartender, sir.
The late Doctor Who handpicked Mr. Lake for inclusion in the Seven, Arjun pointed out.
And now he's ramrodding this...
Yur looked about at the group and gave out an incredulous snort.
I don't even know how to describe it. Ragtag makes it sound like more than it is.
He led them out of a difficult situation, Arjun said.
A difficult situation for which he's partly responsible, sir, Yur shot back.
And at the moment he knows more about the diggers and the situation on the ground than anyone. I assume he requested those objects for a reason, which will be explained as we go.
Tai held up a hand.
Sergeant Major Yur doesn't trust me because my allegiance isn't clear to him.
Fair enough.
Yur's face softened a little, and his gaze flicked to one side for a moment. Taking advantage of this break in the stare-down, Tai turned to face Issa Arjun. The Ivan made the tiniest movement that was still recognizable as shaking his head no. Once he was certain that Tai had caught it, he looked at Roscos Yur.
Sergeant Major, Arjun said quietly, there are more things in heaven and earth than are dreamt of in your philosophy.
Yur snorted. Is that a fancy way of saying it's above my pay grade, sir?
Yes.
I just want to know if it's some kind of fucking Duke shit, sir.
Oh, is that all? Tai asked. Why didn't you say so?
No, Arjun said, the tension suddenly gone from his voice. There's no Duke involved.
Because that bar he works for,
it's not connected with any established coupole.
Then who the hell is it connected with, sir?
Yor demanded. I made some inquiries with friends of mine in Intel. That bar makes no fucking sense as a business proposition. Its ownership structure is unusual. Connections to Red, I'm told.
One of the owners happens to be of part Aiden ancestry, Tai admitted. But be careful of making unwarranted assumptions about where his loyalties lie.
Does this have something to do with the purpose? Roscoe's Yor demanded. Neither Tai nor Arjun answered. After a few moments of this silence, Yor heaved a sigh, then continued in a more moderate tone.
Never mind. I see it now. It's some kind of purpose thing, above my pay grade. You should have just told me.
He drew himself up and saluted.
What are my orders, sir?
We march to the sea, Tai said, following the Sykes directions and moving as fast as we can. Complicating matters is that our Moirin may have to be carried.
Actually, said Langobard, who had been loping in their direction and was now in earshot, we may have to work rather hard to keep up with her.
He extended one long arm, pointing down the slope of the meadow. The first thing they all saw was the huge form of Belid charging downhill at the near sprint that, as they all knew, he could maintain for hours. Far ahead of him, then, they saw Cath Amalthova III moving even faster. Hope's drugs and probiotics had settled Cath III's mood a bit and reduced the nausea to the point where she could almost ignore it. This had been resolving on its own, but she was glad of any pharmaceutical assistance she could get. Her body had become ravenous, and she needed to keep her food down. But the most important drug in her system right now, so important that Hope had strapped a little pump to Cath3's arm, the better to keep dribbling it in, was one designed to home in on her amygdala and put the brakes on any slow neurological train wreck that might be underway there in reaction to the trauma she had seen 4 days ago. As such, it was reaching her brain a few days too late, but apparently it was one of those better-late-than-never things. It might help interrupt a vicious cycle in which her brain would keep replaying that little horror movie over and over, deepening the damage a little bit each time. The fact that she'd spent so much time asleep might also be helping her in that regard. Some tangible and biologically measurable benefit might be accrued to her as a result of having spent most of that time physically strapped to Belid, her cheek to his shoulder, all but sucking him into her nostrils. For his part, the Teclan had shown no particular reaction to having an indolent, vomit-scented coma patient on his back during the day and curled up against his belly during the night. The two of them had still never had sex, but she feared now that once she was cleaned up and feeling better, she would be on him like a succubus. It was a well-known potesh symptom, which had produced colorful and legendary results in Moirin communities that had survived collective trauma. But since having rampant sex with everything that moved wasn't really an option today, she sought other outlets for her surging physical energy. The hike from the meadow down to the sea was longer than it had appeared, and she ended up ranging far in front of the others, obliging Belid to push himself hard just to keep her in sight. She could not see him because he was behind her, but she could sense his footfalls through the ground. She could hear his breathing and the faint clicking of the ambots that he carried on his person, and when the wind was from behind, she could smell the institutional wipes that he had been using for hygiene, and the detergent that had been used to clean his uniform, the lubricant on his cat, his most recent meal. Her ranging so far out in front of the others was partly a way to burn off a physical energy that threatened to make her crazy, but as much an effort to get into a place where she was not taking in an equal amount of sensory data from everyone in the group. One was enough. She stormed through a hedge of whippy plants that had been seated in a dune above the beach and broke out onto the wet sand. Waves were breaking half a kilometer out and washing up toward her in fizzing sheets. The smell in her nostrils spoke of an incalculable density of marine life, akin to what she had scented when she had stood on the top of the bridge in Cradle, but much more finely resolved now. This despite the chemically induced suppression of her amygdala. Without Hope's drugs in her system, she might have spiraled into a sort of panic attack. As it was, she felt her body overheating and looked down at her bare arms as if expecting them to crack open like sausages on a grill.
Dropping from a run to a stride, she marched straight down the beach, peeling off clothes as she went, and depositing them in a ragged career over her footprints. Soon, but not soon enough, the surf was washing her ankles, then her shins. She dropped to her knees and let herself topple forward into an onrushing wave that caught her fall and let her down easy. Naked, she was floating face down in the water, whose icy cold only made the exposed parts of her skin, buttocks and shoulder blades, feel as if they were under a broiler. Pressed for a rational explanation of why she was lying face down in the Pacific, eyes open, gazing at a starfish, she could not have answered. But it was having an effect. Her heart, which had been thumping out of control, dropped to something much closer to a normal rate, and a surprising amount of time passed before she felt obliged to plant her hands and knees in the sand, push herself up on all fours, and suck in a breath of air. She got her legs under her and squatted, then pivoted so that her back was to the sea. Her legs and buttocks were still submerged, cooling off from the run. Belad Tomov was standing a few meters away, surf washing around his ankles, breathing heavily, looking as though a dip in the icy Pacific might do him some good. But this was not his intent. He had been ready to pull Cath 3 out if she had gone too long without breathing. They looked at each other, Cath 3's gaze saying, "I would do you right here, right now," and his saying, "I know," and hers saying, "I know that you know." "Did you hear anything?" he asked. That was unexpected. "Just now," he explained, "when your head was under."
"You mean in the water?"
"Yes."
"Like what?"
"You haven't been listening, have you?"
"Are you kidding? I've been listening so hard it's driving me out of my mind."
"To the conversation, I mean."
"No, everyone talks too loud."
He considered it. Then he turned a little to one side and stretched out one arm, drawing her attention to a rocky headland that interrupted the beach a few hundred meters away. "There," he said. The thermal spike in her body had finally subsided, so she pulled her clothes back on, and they walked along the beach toward the headland, an abrupt, almost artificial-looking rampart of shattered rock held together by the roots of trees and scrub. It divided the beach like the blade of a shovel. She did not even know why they had been going to the sea. Was someone going to pick them up there? Was there even a plan? Or had they simply run away until they could run no farther? "The diggers believe," Belad said, "in the existence of people who live beneath the sea, the pingers. Supposedly there have been contacts at specific places along the coast of Beringia." He nodded in the direction they were going.
"As in face-to-face contacts?"
Belad shrugged, a movement that, given the size of his shoulders, could almost be picked up on a seismograph. "I fancied you might have heard something while your head was under the water," he said. "They use a tech called sonar." Her disordered brain was a little wild putting this all together. She knew a little about sonar. Survey used it to map the bottoms of lakes and to count fish.
"No coincidence that we are traveling with someone of that name?"
Belad nodded. "She has been telling us about them, but much of it sounds more legend than fact."
"Where do they live? Submarines?"
He shrugged again. "No one seems to know. Apparently they are good at holding their breath." The headland could not be skirted without a boat. They ended up cutting back inland so that they could get past it. This required gaining a couple of hundred meters in altitude and bushwhacking through vegetation that had grown thick on the south-facing slope. When they reached a place from which they could look down toward the sea, it became obvious that they were on the edge of an impact crater a kilometer or so in diameter. The headland that had blocked their passage down the beach was part of its rim. This curved out into the Pacific, forming one side of a bay. A mirror image of it, as they could now see, formed the opposite side. The bolide that had formed the crater had struck very close to the shore. The central impact peak was a sharp rocky islet just a stone's toss from the beach, precisely centered between the twin headlands. It was easy enough for the eye to fill in the missing shape of the rim. Out in the water between the headlands, it must be slung in a submerged arc, and indeed it was possible to see waves breaking as they tripped over it. On the landward side, the rim blended into the natural slope. The impact had hollowed out a bowl whose steepness now forced Bellet and Cath 3 to make an awkward, skidding descent into the cove below. The beach there was more rocky than sandy, and many of the rocks had the translucency of wave-worn beach glass. They could hear the remainder of the party on the slope high above, catching up with them. The middle of the beach, just opposite the sharp little island, seemed like the natural place to make camp. A little heap of glassy stones had been made there, just big enough to make it clear that this was no natural deposit, but an intentional act.
"Their signal," Bellet explained. "We should build a fire now."
He began ranging along the beach, picking up driftwood. Cath 3, drawn somehow by the cairn, squatted there to wait for the others. She could hear Sonar Taxlaw chattering as she negotiated the slope above, running circles around the others, whose footfalls and breathing were audible.
"Their history is divided into three deluges. The first deluge was of rock and fire. It chased them into the deepest trenches of the sea, where it never fully dried out, even after the rest of the oceans had boiled off. They bred a race capable of living in confined spaces. The second deluge was of ice and water. The cloudy century," Einstein said. "Yes, when you dropped comets on them for hundreds of years. They noticed that the seas were expanding, growing away from the trenches where they had been holed up, expanding their range. They transformed themselves into a race that could swim in the sea."
"When you say they transformed themselves," asked Arjun, "do you mean genetic engineering or
selective breeding?" Sonar insisted. "If wolves could become poodles in a few thousand years, think what humans could turn into if there was a need. They began to explore the seafloor. They found a lot of industrial junk that had been washed into the oceans during the hard rain and sunk to the bottom. There is nothing of metallurgy that is a mystery to them."
"Which is why you trade with them?" Ty ventured. "Because you are short on metal?"
"And they are short on things we have," Sonar affirmed. "You said there were three deluges," Einstein reminded her. "The third deluge?" "Is now," said the psych. "A deluge of life, beginning with microorganisms and culminating with you."
"Meaning the spacers," Ty guessed.
"Yes. And the only spacers they know about are the ones who dropped a lot of rocks into the Torres Strait and built the thing at Macassar."
"How is all of this being imparted to you?" asked Arjun.
"Imparted?
Have you, Sonar, actually had face-to-face conversations with pingers?"
"Me personally?"
she asked, sounding amazed and horrified by the very idea.
"Oh, no. Just looked down on them from up here."
"So you lurk up above while more senior members of your clan go down to the beach and talk to the pingers?"
"Talking is difficult. Communication is mostly through the written word. They didn't have paper until we gave them some of ours. We use slates and chalk."
Cathry's eye went to a detail she had noticed a minute ago, an unnatural-looking deposit of flat black rocks, half buried in wave-driven sand. As the remainder of the party made their final descent to the water's edge, she used a piece of driftwood to scrape sand and gravel away from these until she could worry one loose. Though it was rough around the edges, it had clearly been shaped by humans, a slab of black rock about as thick as her finger, big enough to hold in the crook of an arm, smooth enough to write on. Scattered in the muck around it, she'd seen lumps of calcium carbonate. Chalk. Traces of it were still visible on the slates. Not writing, but a fragment of a diagram, a map, perhaps, and a few numbers. Projecting from one side of the islet, just below the top of it, was a snarl of driftwood, the stump of a tree that a storm had torn from the edge of a cliff somewhere along the coast and later hurled up here. As soon as he arrived, Ty dropped his pack, emptied his pockets, and picked up the boxy equipment case that Roscoe's Yor had delivered in his glider. Holding this up above his head, To keep it dry, he waded out to the islet, cursing at the intensity of the cold. At its deepest, the water came up to his waist, with occasional waves clipping him under the chin. He tossed the case up onto the flank of the islet, and then clambered up after it. After gazing curiously at the stump for some moments, he squatted down, gripped it by a couple of protruding roots, and overturned it, causing it to tumble into the surf. He then edged back out of the other's sightline to reveal what had been hidden beneath it, a vertical section of stout steel pipe, about a hand's breadth in diameter, rising to the height of a person's knee, topped with a flat disc of battered steel the size of a dinner plate. The pipe wasn't rooted to the boulder itself. It was part of a longer object that extended out into the sea. The part above the waterline was lashed to spikes that had been driven into crevices in the rock, in a style that they had already learned to recognize as typical digger improvisation. Ty's attention strayed to something he had noticed at his feet. He bent down and heaved it up so that all on the beach could see it. A sledgehammer, improvised from a length of pipe and a chunk of steel. Then he looked at the psych. Looking back at Ty, she held her hands out, palms toward the gray sky, as if to say, "See, just like I said." Ty turned away from them, gazing down into the sea before the boulder. After a few moments, he turned back around.
"How far does it extend?" he shouted.
"The pipe? A few score yards," answered the psych. "The crater is as a horn, channeling the sound out into the deep." She had scarcely finished the sentence before Ty hauled off with the sledgehammer and brought it down with all his might on the steel plate. The result was a blindingly loud metallic ping, drowned out, as it faded, by a scream from Cathree, who sank to her knees in the sand with her hands clamped over her head.
"Better get her out of here," Ty said.
She could hear him through her hands. She felt Bellad reaching around her from behind, crooking her in one arm below her breasts, heaving her to her feet. Which was welcome on one level. But she was tired of being the one who had to be carried, and so she unwound herself from him, turned her back on the sea, and marched up toward the belt of scrub that marked the limit of the beach. Ty gave her a respectable head start, before shouting,
"Plug your ears!"
She did so, and a moment later felt another ping go through her like an icicle jammed into the base of her skull. A moment later came another, and another, not in a steady rhythm, but sporadic. And by the time she had climbed up to a place where she could look down over the cove, fingers in her ears, and not suffer pain from each stroke of the hammer, she had made sense of what Ty was doing. Each of the human races had its own set of cultural traditions that it traced back to its respective Eve. These were propagated from one generation to the next by social rituals, school curricula, and youth groups. Young Teclans learned zero-gravity gymnastics with a martial arts flair, competing on obstacle courses that reproduced specific maneuvers that Tekla had performed during the epic. Julians competed on debate teams, and went on lengthy retreats intended to symbolize their Eve's exile and ordeal in the swarm, and so on. Young Dynans learned Morse code. It was used very rarely. Moirans most certainly didn't learn it, and so Cathree had no idea what message Tyura Tom Lake was banging out into the deep. Everyone, of course, had watched the scene in the epic at the beginning of the hard rain, where Eve Dinah had made her final transmission to Rufus. This had trailed off with many repetitions of the code QRT, which, especially after Dinah had dissolved in sobs and slowed her transmission speed to a crawl, had a kind of solemn fanfare-like rhythm to it, beginning with pom, pom, pa-pom, the letter Q. Cathree recognized that pattern, at least, more frequently than you would expect in normal English sentences. So, Ty was using ancient Q codes to shorten his message. But she hadn't a clue what he was actually saying. He belted it out over and over again, a syncopated phrase of long and short strokes that started to get under her skin after a while. He stopped when Sonar Taxlaw waded out to the rock and assured him that, if the pingers were about, they would surely have heard the message by now.
How long now?
He asked. He was shouting over the rush of the surf, and because he had probably gone deaf.
Depends on how far away they are, said Sonar Taxlaw. Maybe a day, maybe three.
Great,
Ty said, and looked up to catch the eye of Roscoe's Yor, who, following a timeless military instinct, pushed his sleeve back to check his timepiece. Ty unlatched the lid of the box and began to take out pieces of equipment and to peruse instructional brochures. Cath-3 was too far away to see the details, and in any case it was getting dark. As the sky faded, she could see Ty sitting on the shore of the islet, facing out toward the sea, occasionally flicking on a small light and fussing with equipment. Perched next to him, swaddled in sleeping bags that Einstein had brought out to her, was the psych. She wore a bulky pair of headphones, occasionally turning her head toward Ty in an alert, bird-like way to make some sort of comment. Issa Arjun paced slowly back and forth on the beach, just out of the wave's reach, passing occasionally near Einstein, who just stood there gazing fretfully at his beloved. Hope had gone to ground in a small tent pitched a few meters higher up on drier sand. A bluish flicker through its walls suggested he was working with a tablet, maybe trying to learn something about potash management. So much for the lower camp, where Hope, Ty, Einstein, Sonar Taxlaw, and Arjun had made themselves at home. Bellad had followed Cath-3 uphill. Langobard and Roscoe's Yor later followed him. Spreading out, bushwhacking in all directions, they identified a curved brow in the slope, the line of demarcation between the crater's inland edge and the pre-existing landscape from which it had been blasted. Above it, the slope was much gentler. Indeed, the first thing one saw upon cresting the rim was a slight drop in altitude. Before them, as they stood with their backs to the sea and their faces to the mountains, was a bog a few hundred meters in extent, with a pine forest rising up on its far side. They backpedaled a few paces and set to work establishing an upper camp just below the summit of the rim. Few words were spoken, but it was obvious that its purpose was to defend the beach if and when Red forces approached. If the foe came straight down out of the mountains, they would have to cross the bog. If they came along the beach, they would have to scale or circumvent a prong of the crater's rim. Either way, they would be clearly visible from this vantage point. It could be guessed that an Onan had struck the ground somewhere nearby several decades ago. Seed-packed Psywise had slithered out of it, roaming about, mapping elevations and soil moisture, comparing notes over a mesh network. The collective had noticed the break in the slope leading down to the sea. Following a program drilled into it by some coder up on the ring, it had decided that the coastline might be stabilized here by planting some seeds that would grow up into tough, low, scrubby vegetation. And so it had all come to pass. Psywise that happened to wander away from the beach had found the flat ground beyond the rim and planted it with different species that would thrive in a wet environment. The vegetation had created a bit of a natural dam, holding back water coming down out of the mountains above them. One day it might be a lake, but for now it was a black bog, squishy and knee-deep, and screened with grasses and reeds that favored that sort of ground. Cath, too, had not been a fighter. Her weapons training had given her the bare minimum of skill needed to discharge a catapult in the direction of a hungry canid. Cath-3 didn't know, yet, whether that was one of the things that had shifted. In a sense, it did not matter. No matter how good she might turn out to be at combat, she would never be as effective as Bellad, Bard, and, judging from appearances, Roscoe's Yor. She was, however, finding them to be a dull, slow bunch. They failed to notice much that was obvious to her, and it was clear that they were tired and fading towards sleep. After it had gotten fully dark, Cath-3 consumed three consecutive full meals from the rations that Roscoe's Yor had brought with him, then slipped away and climbed a short distance farther up to the very top of the rim, from which she could look and listen inland. When she returned, she startled Roscoe's Yor, whose steady breathing had been audible from 1,000 paces away. He'd been asleep, or close to it.
"You should warn me when you are approaching, Cath-2," he hissed.
"She's dead." Cath 3, then. No one is coming, she said. At least not for a few hours.
Not unless they drop from the sky, he retorted.
Langobard, ever sociable, had approached.
They will not come by air, he said. If they can take us out quietly, they will do so, and never say a word of it. But to make a full assault? That would clash with the narrative that they are building for the consumption of the people of the ring.
When are we going to begin writing our own fucking narrative? Yor said. And there the conversation stalled. But his question was answered an hour later when Cath 3, then the rest of them, discerned a whine and a rumble coming from the direction of the water. Running lights appeared over the horizon, coming from the south over the limit of the world, but then winked out as the pilot made the decision to run dark. It was clear from the sound, and from the way it hugged the water, that this thing was neither an airplane nor a ship, but the in-between thing known as an ark. They heard it suff into the water a kilometer away and switch over to the chugging engines it used to maneuver on the surface. It dropped anchor several hundred meters offshore, well away from the land, so as to respect the hair-trigger sensibilities of the diggers, but close enough that people and gear could be ferried to and fro on small boats. It opened its big rear cargo ramp, allowing the sea to flood its interior and float a collection of small boats and barges that had been packed aboard. On one of these, a small party came ashore. Cath 3 heard them conversing, mostly with Ty and Arjun, though Einstein, as usual, found a way to make himself part of the action. A barge from the Ark had been towed into the open water between it and the shore and anchored. The sounds coming from it spoke of complex mechanical internals. After a few minutes, it began to rumble and hum, and a fountain of glittering flink chain, an upside-down U, grew out of its top and began to extend skyward as its velocity built and its sound sharpened into a steady, keening note. Within a few minutes, the A-train had elevated to a height of perhaps 100 meters and begun to give off a soft light, filling the cove and the beach with enough illumination for people to move about easily and read documents. Cath 3 could now read the name of the Ark, blazoned on its fuselage near the nose. Darwin. It must have been sent out from a big terraform base, most likely Haida, which served the northern Pacific coast. The A-train that they had deployed on the barge was a common enough military device. As such, it was probably radiating in other wavelengths besides just visible light. It was a sort of all-in-one communications hub that was interconnecting everything that had line of sight to it, as well as uplinking to Denali and other installations in the ring. Sleep was now out of the question for Cath 3, and so she made her way down the crater to the beach. When she emerged from the brush, she discovered Einstein and the psych standing next to each other in a crossfire of lights, facing a camera. To one side, sorting through notes, was a new arrival, a tall Moiran woman with the posture, the self-possession, and the golden eyes of a fashion model. She wore clothing suited for the chilly, damp coast of Beringia. It hung on her slender but strong frame in a way that suggested it had been made for her, probably by a clever designer on the Great Chain. Cath 3 didn't have to get any closer to understand what was happening. The tall Moiran woman was producing just what Roscoe's Yor had asked for. She began by talking directly into a camera for some time, then interviewed Einstein and the psych. It was all being beamed live to the ring. Cath 3 sat alone on the beach, hugging her knees and watching the woman do what she did, and wondering what events in her life had caused her to shift into what she was now, so tall, so lovely, so watchable. She did not have the manner of one who had been born beautiful, which made Cath 3 suspect that she had come by it through some kind of personal disaster. After she was finished doing her interviews, she shut down the lights and the cameras, approached Issa Arjun, and stood face to face with him for a while, just talking. Both of them had put on VARPs, and Cath 3 got the idea that they were conversing about whatever it was that the devices were projecting into their eyes. Cath 3 became certain that Cath 2 had seen the woman broadcasting from trouble spots around the ring, habitats where general strikes or civil disorder had gotten out of hand, where quarantine enforcement or police had been called in to break things and hurt people. The mere fact that Cathree was sitting still long enough to make such observations and to string such thoughts together was indicative of a coming crash, the inevitable result of how she had spent most of the day. It was about halfway between midnight and dawn, and Cathree felt herself plummeting toward sleep with the same power and inevitability as endurance diving into her final pass through perigee. Instead of which, she found herself gazing at, and being gazed at by, the tall Moiran woman, who had silently drawn almost to within arm's length of her. Cathree jumped to her feet and nearly fell over.
"Cath Amalthova III," the woman said. "I am Cantabrigia Barth V."
Five. Wow. "You must have seen some crazy shit," Cathree said. "I hope for your sake you have taken a set in your current form." Cantabrigia V made a tiny movement of her golden eyes by way of acknowledging the remark, but let it pass without comment.
"I am what amounts to the commanding officer here," she said.
It was neither the craziest nor the least crazy thing Cathree had heard lately, so she took it impassively. By outward appearances, Cantabrigia V was a video journalist. But it made sense that, in a world where no police or military action could be judged successful unless it looked good to ordinary persons watching it on video screens, she was also a general. Arjun had approached from behind Cantabrigia V, and now took up a position just to one side, peering over her right shoulder. He caught Cathree's eye briefly, and nodded.
"Over the wireless," said Cantabrigia V, "I just now spoke to Sergeant Major Ure and Lieutenant Tomov and Langobard, and gave them their instructions. These are yours. A small red military force is approaching. They are still some hours away. We have intelligence that they are being guided this way by two diggers familiar with the route. When they get here, there may or may not be a fight. If there is, do not enter into it directly. Stay clear of our buckies. Look for the diggers. If you can prevent them from doing harm, by all means do so. But dead diggers on a video screen is a thing we cannot afford."
Cathree nodded. "I understand." Arjun apparently felt that some explanation was required. "We don't know when or if the pingers will show up, so we need to buy time."
"Okay," Cathree said. "What are we hoping to buy it with?"
The look on Arjun's face suggested that the question had been impertinent, but Cantabrigia V responded by reaching up to remove the VARP she had perched atop her head. She swept it off and handed it to Cathree, who arranged it carefully on her own face. The fit was imperfect, and so she had to hold it in position with one hand to get the right focus.
"You'll want the soundtrack," said Cantabrigia V. "It's just not the same otherwise."
"Soundtrack?" Cathree said. But a faint shift in the set of Cantabrigia V's face hinted that some deadpan humor was at work, and that she should just play along. Groping along the sides of her head, she found the earbuds and flipped them down into position. The VARP was causing her to see a number of imaginary objects, most of which were grayed and or blurred. It had figured out that Cathree was not its owner, and so it had disabled anything personal or private. Hanging in space between her and Arjun, however, was a softly glowing red token having the apparent size of a table tennis ball with a dimple in one side. He reached out and gave this a light tap, and it flew in her direction.
"Be my guest," he said.
She caught it in her hand and put her thumb into the dimple, then swooped it around in a big oval in front of her face. This caused a flat screen to make itself visible. She then drew the red ball toward her, sweeping the screen through a third dimension to define a volume about the size of a laundry basket. Cantabrigia V hadn't been kidding about the soundtrack. It was a full orchestra, comprising some instruments that would have been familiar to Mozart and others that had been invented thousands of years after Zero. It and a large choir poured a three-dimensional ocean of sound into her ears, performing the Red National Anthem. Not the peppy, truncated version
heard at sporting events, but the symphonic arrangement, calculated to make people sit still and be awed. A nickel-iron fist seemed to be hanging in the volume of space she had just swept out above the beach, the kulak. Stout spars jutted from it here and there, anchor points for hair-thin lines of rigging that extended in various directions, seeming to disappear in the vast distance. Moving carefully, lest she turn an ankle on a cobble, Cathy circled around it until she could peer down the hole in the center. There she saw movement, rings of light, each of them similar to the great chain, stacked up the interior, each spinning at a different rate, all but protected within the lumpy shell of the asteroid, many kilometers thick. This triggered a programmed camera movement that took her by surprise and obliged her to plant her feet and steady herself by laying a hand on Cantabrigia V's forearm. The POV, or point of virtual view, took a slow dive down the center of the kulak, which had now expanded far beyond the basket-sized volume to surround her. She could not control the speed of the movement, but she could gaze in all directions and see through the glass roofs of the ring-shaped cities, picking out green fields where youngsters were kicking balls, blue ponds around which lovers strolled hand in hand, bustling high-rise districts, residential utopias, cozy schools, and military bases where betas and Neoanders practiced martial arts and marksmanship under the billowing red flag. "Is this all real, or a mix?" said Arjun, "of stuff they've actually built and renderings of what they imagine." "And has this actually been made public, or?"
"Broadcast 6 hours ago," he said. "It's a huge reveal."
Never before had Red divulged any pictures, real or imagined, of the inside of the kulak. By now the fly-through had reached the far end, and she could see space opening up around her as the POV exited from the kulak's maw. The familiar sight of the habitat ring became visible, sweeping around in both directions to enclose the blue earth in its jeweled embrace. From the system of rigging woven around the iron fist, a cable descended straight to the equator. Slowly at first, then building speed, the POV descended, achieving in a few seconds what would have taken several days in any kind of realistic elevator. Even through a screen of bright clouds, Cathy could pick out the complex landforms of Southeast Asia to the north and, to the south, the huge dun slab of Australia, now joined to New Guinea by a lumpy gray-green tendril. The POV chose to zoom down on that first, coming close enough that it became possible to see a road traversing the land bridge. Then it veered and banked onto a northwesterly course, following the green, steaming spine of New Guinea to the cape at its end, where it nearly touched the equator. There, construction was visible. Cleared land, buildings, excavations, a hazy web of infrastructure, glimpsed but not lingered on. The POV soared out over a turquoise sea, cluttered with landforms she recognized vaguely from having seen them on maps. But after a few moments, her eye was drawn to something that was flagrantly unnatural, looking as if it had been drawn in with a ruler and a pencil. The tether from the kulak, plunging vertically into the ocean between two big islands. These, she realized, had to be Borneo and Sulawesi, and the water between them, the Makassar Strait. The POV's movement slowed, then stopped. The symphony and the choir were laboring through a slow crescendo. A change, more felt than seen, came over the display. The programmed camera movement was finished, and the VARP was now responding once again to Cathy's movements. Like a giantess bestriding the strait, she could move around and look at it from different angles. For a moment, nothing really happened. Then her eye picked up turbulence in the sea, around where the tether stabbed into it. The surface was welling up and foaming. The tiny wrinkles of normal surface waves were erased, replaced by vast green whorls and galactic arms of swirling foam. Bending forward, she saw angry gulls wheeling about. That detail convinced her that what she was seeing was real, not a rendering. The disturbed region grew north and south, spreading away from the cable, which she knew to be on the equator, without growing east-west. The cable forked, then forked again, becoming a fan that broadened north and south to support the full length of whatever was roiling the strait. It erupted from the surface first at the equator, then proceeded to rip a gash in the sea that spread up and down the meridian with immense velocity. The object could hardly be observed at first for all the water draining from it, plunging in multiple Niagaras back into the sea and hurling up a storm front of spray that rose higher than the structure itself. But in a minute, the gnomon became visible. Cath 3 had to back away to get a picture of the whole length of it. She extended her left hand and made a counterclockwise knob-twiddling gesture, reducing the volume of the Kyoto Philharmonic's brass section before the bass trombones and kettle drums imploded her skull. If the designers of the gnomon had intended to make the anti-cradle, they could hardly have done better. It had the long, wicked curve of a katana, the better to follow the curvature of the earth, combined with the translucent delicacy of an insect's exoskeleton. Indeed, it seemed to be unfolding, reshaping itself as it rose into the air, an origami praying mantis molting into a larger body. Its manifold corrugations and arching carapaces spoke of a million djinns toiling in cubicles for centuries to build the strongest thing they could imagine with minimum weight.
What's it made of?
Carbon and magnesium, mostly, said Arjun. Two light, strong materials that can be extracted from ocean sediments.
Is that how they did it?
Yes, said Cantabrigia V. Energy intensive, Arjun remarked. They ran power down the tether to a production facility on the ocean floor.
They had workers living on the ocean floor?
Robots.
And therein lies an opportunity, said Cantabrigia V.
The producers of this spectacle had once again seized control of the POV and begun taking Cath 3 on a forced march up the length of the gnomon, slowing down to linger on the good bits and zooming past what was repetitive. She got the idea, which was that it had a sort of carriage that could move north-south on a giant rail and connect with the ground along a range of latitudes, that it had its own internal train lines connecting residential pods, military installations, luxury resorts for the whole family, and so much more. It was obviously rendered, stuff that hadn't actually been built yet. Her inability to control what the POV was doing made her a little queasy. She levered the earbuds up, closed her eyes, and carefully pulled the VARP away from her face. Then she opened her eyes on reality, the beach, the islet, the two interlocutors. She handed the VARP back.
What sort of opportunity?
If you are going to make first contact with an intelligent alien race, said Cantabrigia V, dropping huge strip-mining robots into their homeland might not be your best move. Cath 3 pondered that one for a bit.
Ah,
she said.
Yes.
So there's a reason why they were so keen to make nice with the diggers. Having fucked it up spectacularly with the pingers.
Yes.
Cantabrigia 5 stared at her for a little while. Her silence and her gaze were impressive, yet Cath 3 did not feel wholly uncomfortable. Finally, she went on.
Actions taken here today will cast long shadows into the future of New Earth. With more resources here, we might have effected a more elaborate strategy with less uncertainty. But the mere fact of having had more would have spoiled it.
How did you guys come up with all this? Ty asked. He was squatting on the islet next to the psych, who was still swaddled in sleeping bags, only her hands and head exposed. She was holding an instruction manual, angling it toward the light of the flink chain. This was still illuminating the cove, but the crew of Ark Darwin had dimmed it so that people could sleep. She had to focus intensely to read the words, many of which must be unfamiliar to her. Her lips moved slightly as she parsed unfamiliar Cyrillic characters sprinkled through almost every word. Headphones buried her ears in great donuts of foam.
She hadn't heard Ty, didn't know he was looking at her. So he had his fill of looking for a minute. She wasn't his type, and anyway she was very young. But he was beginning to see what Einstein saw in her. Einstein had to know that there was nobody for him on his riz, no indigent girl he could have an interesting conversation with. And yet if he were to somehow find his way to the habitat ring, he'd be looked on by all the smart girls there as a hillbilly. The device in the box was a portable sonar rig. It was capable of sending out pings, but that wasn't how they were using it. They were using it to listen. Sonar Tax Law had virtually wrenched it from Ty's grasp and mastered it. The arrival of Ark Darwin and the movements of the boats and the barge had caused her no end of annoyance, but with a little encouragement from Ty, she'd begun to see it as an interesting science experiment, a way of understanding what those technologies must sound like to pingers and other mammals that frequented the deep. Moving carefully on the steep, glassy surface of the islet, he edged into her peripheral vision and gave her a light tap on the shoulder. He hated to break her out of her reverie, but there were questions he needed answered. She was stunned for a moment, as if she'd just been teleported into this location from 1,000 miles away, but rapidly she came around and pulled one of the headphones away from her ear.
Come again?
All of this. Ty rested a hand on the battered plate atop the pipe, nodded toward the makeshift sledgehammer. How did you come up with it? How do the pingers know that when they want to talk to you, they should build a cairn on the beach at such and such place?
We began sending out scout parties as soon as the atmosphere became breathable, Sonar said.
Let it be 300 years ago, Ty said.
282.
Just making the point that this is old history.
Not that old.
Ty heaved a sigh. Not within living memory.
It is not merely an oral tradition, if that's what you're getting at, Sonar said. We maintain written records.
On 100% cotton paper, yes, go on.
Well, there was nothing for the scouts to eat, of course, so they could only range as far as they could go with food that they carried on their backs. But in time they discovered edible seaweed and bivalves along the coast.
Ty nodded. Once Terraform's engineer Algy had done its job of building the atmosphere, it needed to be held in check. Terraform seeded the coasts with filter feeders and the oceans with krill.
Those clams were the first meat anyone had eaten in 4,700 years, said the psych. Scout parties that hugged the coast could stay out as long as they wanted and roam for months or years, eating better than the diggers who stayed in the hole.
Being a scout must have been popular.
Too popular. Some went rogue and had to be hunted down and subjected to the discipline of the committee.
That sounds unpleasant.
It was not a good time. A lot of what you see that is bad in our culture started in those years.
Anyway, these scouts would emerge from the hole, said Ty, and make a beeline for the nearest coast.
Exactly, and this route we have been traveling is like a game trail for us. We know it backwards and forwards. Well, at some point, after discipline had been reestablished, a scout party was exploring the coast a few kilometers from here, making camp up in the trees. One of them looked down and saw a person just walk up out of the sea. This person carried a little shovel, like you might use to dig clams, and had a basket, but no clothes. He or she dug some clams and tossed them into the basket, and then strolled back down into the ocean and disappeared.
No scuba gear, no wetsuit.
Correct, just a belt with a knife. Well, word of this got back to the hole, and they talked to a predecessor of mine.
A previous sonar tax law, you mean?
Yes. A scout party went back down to the same place the next year and set up a contraption like this one, except not as good, and used it to send signals out into the deep. Nothing. Years, then decades went by. All they had to go on was the one sighting. Some old digger who had been on a lot of scouting parties came up with the idea of building a bigger and better noisemaker here. He reckoned that the shape of the crater would act as a horn,
channeling the sound outwards. To make a long story short, it worked. Contact was made.
How recently?
About 50 years, Sonar said. Then it was broken off around the time that you had your war. 5 years ago, though, we began to see Cairns.
Cath 3 was awakened much as Cath 2 had been on the morning when she had seen the digger from her glider, by a certainty that something was out there, supported by no real evidence. This time, she was responding to sound, something she'd heard while still asleep, accessible only through a memory that eluded her the harder she reached for it. She rolled over onto her belly, propped herself up on her elbows, aimed her face uphill, closed her eyes, opened her mouth, and froze. For the first few minutes, she wasn't trying to hear anything, just taking in the ambient soundscape so that she could detect any noises that did not belong in it. The flink chain on that barge was still operating, producing a steady note that could be filtered out by the mind's neural circuitry. She was aware that Bard, too, had suddenly become very quiet, but she didn't know whether he had heard something or was simply following her cue. Cath, too, might have been bookish and unobtrusive, but Cath 3 was the sort of person who kept nearby men on their toes. She heard it again, the same sound that had probably awakened her in the first place. And this time, she knew what it was. Hand-forged steel arrowheads clinking faintly in a quiver, like coins in a pocket. The dilemma of the digger-hunter being that those shafts had to be held loosely enough to be fluidly drawn and knocked, but not so loosely that they jangled with each footfall. In measured strides across level ground, their kit might make no noise, but in a breathless pre-dawn descent of an uneven slope, things might work themselves loose. As that aural picture sharpened in her mind, she could sense footfalls, too, and hear bodies pushing through the brush. The party, she guessed, was more numerous than the jangling quivers. Another Cath 2 memory connected. Preparing for survey work in areas with a lot of indigens, she had read ancient histories of the American West, where white men had made use of aborigines as scouts and guides. Langobard was hearing things too now, and had begun knuckle-walking along the little picket line that they had established below the rim of the crater, quietly waking Roscoe's Yor and Belid Tomov. Cath 3 followed him, going to each man in turn and saying in a low voice, "Maybe two diggers with bows and arrows, guiding a small unit of Neoanders."
"How small?" Belid asked.
"Probably not a full peloton. I will guess it is half of the group we observed landing."
"Go and notify Ty," Belid said. "Tell him to turn the light on." And since it was too dark to see anything, he put a hand on the top of her shoulder, just where it curved up toward the neck, and gave the muscle there a pleasurable squeeze. Then he flattened his palm against her shoulder and gave her a firm shove downhill. A minute later, she was down on the beach. Sonar Taxlaw was still sitting out on the islet, wearing headphones. Einstein was snoring in a sleeping bag. Ty was sleeping in one of the little pop-up shelters that had been supplied by the people from Ark Darwin, which was still anchored offshore, detectable by the slap of waves against its hull. As for Issa Arjun, she nearly collided with him, for he was simply standing there on the beach, robed in the sleeping bag. Odds were 50-50 that he was silently meditating, or that he had gotten up to take a piss. Ivans could be a little funny when their brains got the better of them. Either way, whether he was pissing or thinking, he was temporarily useless, and so she went straight to the shelter and awoke Tyura Tom Lake. That took a bit longer than she had been hoping for, which frustrated her greatly, since it was now so obvious to her that something was happening up above. She could hear the building whine of the body-orbiting flink chains that Neoanders employed as both armor and weapons, but could not tell whether this was Langobard getting ready to mount a defense or the interlopers coming down the hill. The latter she could easily hear now. They had abandoned stealth in favor of haste. "They're coming," she said. "Two diggers, some Neoanders." Ty reached for his catapult, then remembered yet again that it had been taken by Ariane. Bellad says to turn the light on. She was expecting him to use some sort of electronic device, the sort of thing the diggers lumped together under the heading of radio. But instead, Ty rolled up to a seated position, bolted out of the shelter, and simply walked down the beach, hopping and cursing as his bare feet unerringly found stones.
"Turn the light on!" he shouted. He cupped his hands around his mouth. "Hey! Turn the light on!"
In this quiet cove, his words were loud as dynamite. Kathree heard some kind of answering shout from the direction of the barge, and from the boulder, a hissing noise.
Shh, shh.
She thought it was the waves surging against the stone until the flink chain began to glow, illuminating Sonar Taxlaw, who had stood up and turned around to face them. She was shushing them with a finger pressed against her lips.
Shh, be quiet, she insisted.
Full blast, Ty shouted. All you got.
They're coming, said the Psyche. And seeing that no one else cared, she caught the eye of Arjun, who had dropped his robe on the beach like a puddle and was advancing toward her, striding directly into the surf.
We're hurting their ears.
She heard shouting up above, fighters who had dropped all pretense of stealth and were closing for combat. The timbre of their voices was that of Neoanders. Suddenly feeling a desperate need to be up there in the fray, Kathree spun on her heel, getting ready to sprint back up the slope. She nearly collided with Cantabrigia V.
You are going back up?
I feel like I have to, Kathree said.
Godspeed. Remember, no damaged diggers.
Cantabrigia V pivoted away from her in a manner that made the long skirts of her warm cloak flare beautifully and gave Kathree a last look at her regal profile, her excellent posture, emphasized by close-cropped hair. As Kathree scrambled back up, she reviewed the more detailed instructions that Cantabrigia V had given her some hours ago. Stay clear of our buckies. Those would be camera-carrying buckies, shooting video of whatever was about to happen. They'd be programmed to look for clear, high ground. Kathree dropped to a low crouch, perhaps 50 meters shy of Langobard. She could not see him, but she could hear the flinks careering around him as they whacked into small branches. Above and to her right, a boulder projected from the slope. It was too hard and too steep to support anything except moss. The pale stone was prominent in the directional light of the big A-train below. A sapling had found a perch on its top, grappling the rock with a mostly exposed root system, and reaching toward the sky with a few scraggly boughs that had been sculpted by the wind from the sea. Near it she saw movement, which she identified as a bucky rolling into position atop the boulder. She could see it, so it could see her. She flattened herself behind a particularly dense knot of shrubs and grass, and used her ears, which was about all she had to go on just now. Clink, clink. There it was, the sound, again, of those hand-forged digger arrowheads jostling in their quiver, drowned out by the building whine of a nearby flink chain reconfiguring itself under the command of its owner. She risked looking up and saw a Neoander coming out into a place from which he had clear air to that bucky on the boulder. It wasn't Bard. It was a red grunt in military kit. He reached out and closed his right hand on one of the chains flying around him, arresting its movement. At the same time, the chain parted on the opposite side of his body and turned into a whip. It lashed out directly at the bucky on the boulder. Its shape and course were visible at first. Then it accelerated through the sound barrier and became invisible, known only by its results. A sonic bang, the complete disintegration of the bucky, and the toppling of the little sapling, cut clean through. The whip slowed as it arced back in the general direction of its owner, and, like a snake in space, reorganized itself into another flying A-train, spinning in the opposite direction from before. Having thus eliminated a robotic sentry on what to him was the left flank, the Neoander drew back toward the center of the action and disappeared from Kathree's view. Kathree moved toward the boulder. The destruction of one of Cantabrigia V's video buckies made it a good place for her to be.
She was churning headlong toward the base of the rock, wondering how she was going to find her way to the top, when movement above caught her eye. She stopped and looked steeply upward at a digger who had just emerged onto its crown to claim the vacated high ground. He had come down the slope so impetuously that he nearly overran the top of the boulder. He had to plant a foot, just short of disaster, and wheel his arms backward to regain his balance. As he did so, the arrowheads clinked together in his quiver. Cathree froze and crouched, watching him regain his equilibrium. Had he looked straight down, he'd have seen her, but he had eyes only for what was going on to his right. Judging from sounds, the beginnings of a confused fight in a cluttered place. The digger reached back, drew out a single shaft, and knocked it to his steel bow, looking out over the scene of the action below. He was thinking about choosing a target when Cathree's ambot hit him in the shoulder and sent him down twitching. Shooting the man had been easy. Not in the physical sense. That would have been easy in any case, since he was standing right there and the ambot was largely self-aiming. It had been psychologically easy. Days ago, when she'd been in the worst part of her shift, barely conscious, she'd overheard Ty speaking to Einstein. Fighting isn't about knowing how. It's about deciding to. Even in her delirium, she had understood that the decision Ty spoke of wasn't an intellectual one. It was an overcoming of the emotional barrier that, in any civilized society, prevented people from doing damage to each other. She knew that because, hours earlier, she had done it. During that shocking initial combat between the Seven and the Diggers, she had stepped in to protect Ty after Arion had shot him, and the old Digger had struck her on the arm with the Srap Tasmaner, bruising the bone, and something about that intense physical contact had pushed her through the barrier, made it easy to aim her catapult at the man and fire it. Since then, well-meaning members of the group had approached her to offer their sympathies. All they'd wanted to talk about was Doc and Memmi, and what a shock it must have been for Kath to lose them so suddenly. Implicit was that Kath had gone epi because of their deaths. A reasonable-seeming assumption, but wrong. It had happened, rather, in the moment when the old man had attacked her and she had fought back. Doc, at the time, had still been alive, and Memmi, though mortally wounded, had still been breathing. So Kath, too, had actually been the first member of the Seven to die. Anyway, she was now the sort of girl who shot people. Useful to know. This all happened on what Blue would consider its right flank, and Red would call its left. As Aboriginal scouts supporting regular forces, the Diggers would stay on the wings or out in front, which would imply that the other Digger, she was increasingly certain that there were exactly two of them, was likely to be on the opposite flank. The boulder itself was too steep to climb, but ashy talus had spilled to either side of it, forming loose ramps. She churned up one of these and gained an altitude where she could flatten herself against the slope and peer across the battleground. It was contained within a broad, shallow sump where water finding its way down from the slopes of the coastal range was dammed up against the outer wall of the crater. It was heavily grown over, and so its boggy nature was not evident until one set foot in it. Bard, Bellad, and Roscoe Sior had moved aggressively forward, made a show of force, then withdrawn to let the Red Force get literally bogged down. Acting in Blue's favor were difficulties in communication between, on the one hand, tightly organized high-tech Red troops, and on the other, Aboriginal scouts, who only knew about wireless communications because a long line of psychs named Probosidia Rubber had memorized the radio entry. Anyway, Cathree was now well forward of her compatriots, off to what they would call the right side of the bog. In order to reach its opposite flank, she could try going straight across, but this would bring her directly into the envisioned path of the Red Grunts, as well as trapping her in the marsh. She could cut back toward the sea and run along the camp where they'd slept last night, but she already knew that most of the Buckies were stationed there. Or she could proceed farther inland and run through the pine forest that rose above the uphill side of the bog. That would take her directly across Red's line of advance, which seemed like a bad idea on the face of it. But the Reds were just an isolated hit squad, not the vanguard of a larger force. They did not have lines of communication back to their rear. Once they had put ground behind them, they had no claim to it, no power there. Given that she could move over rough ground faster than even Bellad, and given that she could hear the Neoanders a mile away, she liked her chances. So she kept moving uphill, rather than down, staying well off to the flank until she had gained a bit of altitude, then turning her attention inward. The red Neoanders were clearly audible. All but one of them were below her, and as she paused and waited, she heard the thudding footfalls of the straggler going by her. They were getting orders from their B, or Beta, as per racial stereotype. To her credit, the B was not hanging back and commanding from the rear. She seemed to be in the thick of things, which placed her downslope just where the going started to get marshy enough to give them second thoughts about the way they were heading. They must have noticed by now that the native scout on their left had disappeared, which might encourage them to steer toward the right. In any case, they were briefly stymied. They were all downhill of Cath 3, and they were all facing the other way. Looking directly across the slope, she saw nothing but tall, pine-like trees, forming a canopy that had stifled development of undergrowth. It would be easy going. A traversing run would take her rapidly to the opposite side of the field of battle, where she ought to be able to follow the other digger's trail down to wherever he'd stationed himself and zap him with an ambot before he was able to do anything heroic and stupid. The bang of a Neoander's flink whip sounded from below, and she heard someone cry out and a clamor of wanging noises as ambots were projected toward targets. Feeling suddenly very late, she began to run through the trees, moving openly now. When gaps appeared, she looked down across the bog. The vantage from here was excellent, which explained why she nearly collided with a lone man who had stationed himself in one of those clear places, perfectly situated to overlook the bog and the cove below. His only company was a robot, a Psywai with a video camera for a head, capable of rising up out of its coils like a cobra from a basket and aiming its lens in any direction. The man was standing with his back to the fight, facing his Psywai, which was shooting down the hill. Cath 3 was quite close to that Psywai when she stumbled upon this, and so when she first took it all in, she understood the setup exactly, just as a billion red viewers would be doing in a few minutes. In the foreground, the man, framed in rugged rocks and trees that would fill habitat dwellers with that aching need to come down here and colonize the surface. In the near background, the bog, where the fighting was underway. Beyond that, the cove, nestled between the pincers of wave-beaten rock, the flink barge with its column of light making the whole scene come into day, Ark Darwin farther out, rocking slowly on low seas, and the sky, adding some light of its own, as the dawn approached. The man wasn't expecting her. She got the impression, somehow, that he'd been rehearsing, going over his lines, clearing his throat, preparing for a performance. So she had a few moments in which to stare at him. The three incarnations of Cath Amalthova had, in their collective lifespan, only laid eyes on live Arateics a few times, and then only from a distance. So she had no clear measure of what counted as impressive or handsome among that race. But this one had to be one of the finer specimens. He must be over 2 full meters in height. His long raven hair was swept back from his forehead to make the most of a high, noble brow, a strong, prominent nose, large, jet-black, deep-set eyes. A few creases on his face gave him an air of sober maturity. 5,000 years ago, aristocracy had died, along with almost everything else, and yet the idea of aristocracy, the aspirations that it, at least in an idealized form, drew out of the human psyche, lived on in everything about this man's appearance, his attire, his posture, and the way in which he gazed upon Cath 3 when he had recovered from his astonishment and understood what was happening. The look on his face said that this unexpected encounter was fascinating, as well as slightly amusing, the sort of twist of fortune that happened from time to time to sophisticated persons, and that, political differences notwithstanding, the two of them might one day discuss the whole affair wryly over a glass of fine red wine from Antimer. Or at least that was the case, until Kathry's ambot struck him right in the middle of his forehead. Sensing movement and hearing the discharge of her catapult, the Saiwai, which apparently had some rudimentary ability to follow what was interesting, swiveled in her direction, but she stomped at its neck from behind. It gave way beneath the impact of her heel and made a creditable effort to remain standing, but was forced to uncoil itself so as to effect a soft landing on the ground. From there it might have pursued her into the trees, had it been programmed for pursuit. But it was really nothing more than a moderately smart camera platform, and so it stayed where it was, doggedly trying to center the face of the Arateic in the middle of its frame. Since the Arateic was rolling and writhing like a man on fire, this gave its algorithms a vigorous workout. Kathry resumed her headlong run through the trees. She bent her course back toward the sea, entering the final leg of a U-shaped career around the bog. She slowed down. If her conjecture was correct, she must be drawing close to the other digger. And unlike Bard, Bellet, and Roscoe's Yure, she had nothing to protect her from those steel-headed arrows. She heard a creaking noise from uphill, behind her. She turned around to see a red-headed, blue-eyed digger, no more than 5 meters away, holding an arrow at full draw, aimed right at her. The freshly sharpened edges of its hand-forged steel warhead made bright arcs as they reflected the light from the cove. She had holstered her catapult to leave both hands free for scrambling. She had nothing. Cantabrigia V hadn't exactly commanded her to incapacitate both of the digger scouts, just to prevent them from doing harm and to prevent their dead bodies from showing up on video screens around the ring. "You're making a terrible mistake," she said. The digger didn't move, but he did blink slowly. She took it as assent to keep talking. "Those people, the Reds, are only pretending to be your friends so that they can piggyback on your claim to the surface. They want to take it all for themselves."
"And you?" he asked.
"Blue is no better in some ways."
"Then why should we heed your counsel?"
"You should heed no one's counsel blindly, neither mine nor his." She made a little movement of the head toward the Arateic. Silence, as he considered it. "Do you know Salon Congreve?" she asked.
"Of course."
"Has Salon Congreve spoken to you of chess?"
"We do not need a psych to tell us of chess," the digger said. "We play it all the time."
"Then you know that pawns are weak, except for when their position on the board gives them power. Early in the game, they are sacrificed freely. Late in the game, they may checkmate the king." She was interrupted by another whip crack from below, followed by two more in rapid succession. She fought the temptation to turn around and look. The digger's blue eyes strayed toward the battlefield, took something in, then returned to her. At no time did the arrowhead waver. Kathry continued, "You are pawns. You can't begin to imagine how small and weak you are compared to the forces above. If you allow yourself to be played as such by Red, you will be sacrificed as soon as it suits their purposes. If you play a longer game, though, you can yet grow powerful. As powerful as the other human races." With a suddenness that made Kathry flinch, the digger raised his weapon and relaxed the arm that had been drawing the arrow back. He plucked the nock off the string and placed the arrow back in his quiver.
"I take your words with a grain of salt," he said.
"Good.
But some of what you say confirms suspicions that I have harbored in my breast since the coming of the Red People, and so I have made up my mind to go back and speak to the others of these matters."
And then he simply turned his back on Kathry and began hiking back up into the mountains of Beringia.
"I know your story, Tyuratam Lake," said Cantabrigia V, "or at least the portions of it that have made their way into official records."
"Half of it, then."
"Be that as it may, I sense how distracting this must be for you."
She made the tiniest suggestion of a glance up the slope. Even though her eyes were screened by the lenses of a stylish VARP, their golden hue magnified the gesture.
Part of you wishes to join the battle. That's commendable, but I need you. The purpose needs you. Here.
Fine. You have my attention, Ty said. Inappropriately, irrelevantly, he was wondering how old this woman was.
Epigenetic shifts could roll back many of the visible effects of aging. At least one Moiran, Jamaica Hammerhead 12, had lived to the age of 200. Ty's estimate of Cantabrigia V's age increased by a decade every time he interacted with her. Currently, he was thinking that she might be 80 years old.
What do you know of the Pingers? She asked.
In all honesty, they sound more myth than fact.
Myth carries more weight anyway, in times like these.
What do you know of them? Ty demanded.
For once, Cantabrigia V seemed a little off balance. She looked at him sharply, lifted her VARP, rested it on the top of her head.
I need to know, Ty said, whether they came out of some Red gene lab.
Red doesn't even know they exist, said Cantabrigia V.
Did we make them?
Blue?
No, your hypothesis was correct, Ty.
And how would you know what my hypothesis was?
Her eyes strayed to the pizza box, which was leaning against a boulder that protruded from the beach.
I know what is in there.
Thank you, Ty said.
He turned away from her and began striding in the direction of a tall young Ivan, standing on the beach and gazing up nervously toward the sounds of battle.
Einstein, eyes on me. Time for you to make history.
Cracking a whip made of small robots joined end to end into a long, flexible chain was neither an especially bad nor an especially good way of engaging a foe in AMBOT-based combat. Extensive studies conducted within Blue military research labs had concluded that, on average, it was somewhat less effective than the more obvious procedure of just shooting individual AMBOTs out of catapults. A dissenting opinion held that such studies were flawed because they failed to take into account two factors that were important in actual battle. One, the psychological impact on a defender who knew that the attack might literally whip around and come at him from any direction, including around corners or over barricades. Two, the element of skill, which was difficult to measure scientifically. The test subjects wielding those things in the lab were unlikely to have the same knack for it as Neoanders, who had grown up using them and who had access to an ancient body of lore, a martial art, in effect, that they were disinclined to share with anyone else. If the whip was allowed to dissociate in mid-crack, then its component AMBOTs would be flung toward the target at supersonic velocity, which was as good as could be achieved by shooting the same objects out of a catapult. If it made contact with the target, direct physical damage would be inflicted, and the AMBOTs that had inflicted it could decouple themselves and carry out their usual programs. And if the whipcrack was off target, the chain could be recovered in full with no waste of ammunition. All the AMBOTs came back for another attempt, something that certainly could not be said of ones that had been fired out of cats. On Cathree's list, if they ever got out of this, was to sit down over a glass of Pinot Noir with Langobard and ask him where he had picked up his skills in this department, since until recently he had been sustaining a fairly credible cover story about being a peaceful wine merchant in Cradle. She already suspected that he would deflect any such questions by saying that the Antmer Neoanders, like many cultures throughout human history, had a tradition of teaching martial arts to their young ones. A skeptic might remark that fighting with whips made of little robots might be all well and good in the clean and well-ordered confines of a space habitat, or a hollowed-out asteroid, or when dueling in spacesuits in a vacuum, or in relatively uncluttered places, such as deserts and ice caps on the surface. But in a bog full of dense, head-high vegetation, it was simply a mistake. Cathree's ears were taking in vast amounts of data that her brain didn't know what to do with. Someone who had grown up practicing these arts, as Langobard apparently had, might have been able to hear nuances in these repetitive bangs. A crack that landed on its target would sound different from one that dissociated into a burst of flying ambots, which in turn would sound different from the one that had whipped back toward the attacker or gotten fouled up in vegetation. Instead of which, all she could tell was that they were fighting down there. By the time she had completed her circuit of the bog and returned to their original line of defense above the cove, they had been fighting for rather a long time, which she interpreted as good news. She was trying to think like Cantabrigia V, who probably wouldn't worry so much about trivial matters like casualties and the control of the battlefield. More important was the narrative of the battle. And so far what it looked like was that a small blue group conducting treaty-approved survey operations on their side of the treaty-defined boundary had been pursued by bloodthirsty red Neoanders until trapped against the ocean, where they were now putting up a heroic and surprisingly prolonged last-ditch stand to protect a few non-combatants. Cathree didn't wish this to be cynical, for Cantabrigia V really was a fantastically appealing and charismatic person, but she suspected at some level that a blue fatality or two up in the bog and perhaps an on-camera interview with a maimed and bereaved survivor might be the perfect counter for the propaganda coup that the Arateics had scored a few days ago. Thoughts such as those were luxuries she could not afford herself until she had reached a position above the cove, well behind the battle zone. And, no coincidence, also behind the line of camera-carrying buckies recording the heroic rearguard action. She looked down at the lower camp. A sunrise, in weather like this, was too much to ask for, but the sky was getting brighter all the time and was now illuminating the beach more effectively than the towering Aitken loop on the barge. Perhaps in response to the sounds of battle, half a dozen or so inflatable boats had emerged from the flooded hull of Ark Darwin and begun making their way in, each carrying a few people who appeared to be wearing helmets. Good. But, annoyingly to Cathree, they were maintaining some distance. Sonar Taxlaw was standing on the boulder, waving them off. She'd been joined by Einstein, who was doing likewise. That was about to become an intolerably crowded boulder because Tayora Tom Lake was wading out to join them with that pizza box under one arm. He had managed to equip himself with a dry suit, which probably made the experience a good deal more comfortable for him. Cantabrigia V and Arjun were on the shore, facing out to sea, as if there were not a high-pitched battle going on a few hundred meters above them. Two of the buckies dislodged themselves from their positions above Cath-3 and began rolling down the slope like wire-frame boulders. At first this seemed uncontrolled, like an avalanche, but then they began to stretch and deform in a way that accommodated the rocky ground rushing beneath them and slowed to a mincing style of descent. One of them perched on a spot where it could get a clear view of the entire cove, and the other picked its way down to the sand, angling for close-ups, apparently. Cantabrigia V turned toward it and advanced a few steps. Facing squarely into its camera, she began speaking words that Cath-3 had no hope of hearing at this distance. Cath-3 saw all of this while leaning back against the steep pitch of the inner crater wall. Just above her was a line of vegetation that had taken root along its brow, where the ground was level and the sunlight was as plentiful as it would ever get in these parts. It spread for some tens of meters to her left and to her right, walling off the cove from the bog and the high country above. Some loud grunting noises and the sound of a lot of little sticks getting damaged caused her to look sharply to her left, just in time to see two large men, locked together, erupt through the wall of brush and tumble out into the open. Since the slope below was steep, they rolled together for several meters down toward the beach before the larger one, Bellad, was able to lash out with one foot and plant it downslope, bringing both of them to a stop. At the same time, he pushed up with both arms, shoving his opponent, a Neoander, completely off the ground in a bid to flip him backward and send him tumbling down even farther. But the Neoander seemed to anticipate this and made his much longer arms whip around Bellad's torso, scrabbling for purchase on his rib cage. Perhaps 50% of Bellad's body was still covered by ambots, locked together to form a patchy carapace. The Neoander's right hand came down on a cluster of them that was protecting Bellad's armpit, and those obliged their owner by delivering a clearly audible shock to the offending hand. This disrupted whatever grapple the Neoander had been attempting. Still, Belid's gambit had basically failed, and he ended up toppling backward as his opponent's momentum overthrew him. When he understood this, he stopped fighting it and bent his knees, turning what might have been an ungainly sprawl into something more like a back somersault that employed the Neoander's stomach as an impact cushion. Cathree heard a snapping noise, but was a little slow to understand it as a rib being broken. The Neoander, on his back, involuntarily tried to contract into a fetal position, bringing his head up into Belid's descending fist. The contact between the delicate structures of the modern hand and the massive bone arches of the Neanderthal's skull was unequal, and there was more cracking, to Belid's disadvantage. Still, the blow gave the Neoander a jolt, which was enough time for Belid finally to draw a knife from a sheath and press it against the other's throat. He kept pressing until the Neoander's head was against the ground. The fighting, at least that part of it, was over, and Cathree was able for the first time to process a full image of Belid's state. Bloody, half-naked, spitting teeth, breathing much faster than he ever did when sprinting flat out on a treadmill. Anyway, he was alive, and the fight was over for him, unless he chose to neutralize his opponent by cutting his throat, which seemed inadvisable, since he was now under the direct coverage of a Bucky with a camera in it. The ancient Teclan Neoander fights of asteroid mining lore might have ended with throat cutting, but not this one. Other things happened in the bog that she did not see. Langobard emerged with Roscoe's Yore slung over his back in a fireman's carry and began tromping down the slope in some haste, not looking back. Belid, watching, called out a warning to him. In the same instant, Cath heard movement from the bog and saw a human silhouette, not a Neoander, vault through the gap that had been torn in it by Belid and his opponent and begin running after Bard. She was a squat woman with close-cropped hair in military kit, a classic bee. Cathree aimed her catapult at her and fired an ambot, then two more, but all of them somehow missed. The bee was evidently wearing some kind of armor that was good at spoofing this particular model, and so she could stand there all day shooting at her and nothing would happen. Still, the bee heard the catapult go whang and sensed the ambots zipping around her, which was enough to stall her for a moment. She turned toward Cathree. The look on her face suggested that she had not expected to see a female Moirin. As she was taking in this extraordinary spectacle, a fist-sized rock struck her on the downhill side of her head and, to all appearances, killed her. Cathree looked down the slope to see Belid following through from having thrown the rock. He had transferred his unbloodied knife to his broken hand and now shifted it back. Nearby was Bard, who had paused in his headlong sprint toward the beach and turned around to see what Belid was throwing rocks at. Blood seemed to be draining out of him. On second thought, it was draining out of Sergeant Major Yure. The Neoander that Belid had been restraining rolled up to his feet. Just as rapidly, he went down again, and a catapult whang traveled up to Cathree's ears. When Langobard turned around, he saw that Roscoe's Yure, badly mauled but still conscious, had brought his weapon into play with his free hand. If there were other red forces to be accounted for, they were either dead, unconscious, or in retreat toward the mountains. For the first time in what seemed like a while, but had probably been just a few seconds of elapsed time, Cathree directed her attention to what was going on below. The rubber boats from the Ark had made a decision to avoid the middle of the cove. Instead, they were splitting to either side to make landfall on the prongs formed by the crater's rim. From there, they could hike around if need be. A person was walking out of the water. Ty handed the pizza box up to Einstein and told him to open it and to keep what was inside of it dry and near to hand. The dry suit was doing a fine job of keeping his legs warm, and so he decided to remain below, thigh deep in the water next to the islet. His time in the war had left him with distrust, bordering on disgust, with people like Cantabrigia V, who were always thinking about the narrative. But that way of thinking was infectious. He saw the little scene on the islet through the eyes not of Tyura Tom Lake, but of a video camera beaming coverage to the ring. And he thought it looked perfect the way it was. The small conical spike of glass, grubby around the waterline with wave-washed sand, supporting two people. Einstein with the pizza box, and, standing next to him with a finger hooked through his belt loop, the psych with one headphone on and the other off. In fact, he attended so closely to the image that he almost missed the main event. The look on the others' faces told him he had best turn around and look out to sea. Only the head and shoulders were protruding above the waves. The pinger was trudging up the sloping floor of the crater as if returning from a casual underwater stroll. He or she breathed loudly and deeply for a little while, apparently reoxygenating, but then settled down to a more normal respiration. Where did they live? Where had this person come from? They must have diving bells or something that moved about underwater. The pinger was hairless and sleek, and, as soon became evident, lacked external genitalia. So, a woman? But if so, it was a woman without breasts, and as far as Ty knew, these were still mammals. A few paces behind was a roundish object that presently turned out to be supported by a neck, which turned out to be anchored in a sloping pair of shoulders. This one did have breasts, and behind her was yet a third person of the same general description. As the first one ascended into shallower water, the shape of his body became clearer, round, and in general, sort of projectile-like. Some part of Ty's brain wanted to identify him as a fat man, and maybe he was fat, in the same way that an otter or a seal is, a thick layer of subcutaneous fat held in beneath a taut, rather thick-looking skin. But in no way did he seem flabby or jiggly. His overall style of movement suggested heavy musculature hidden beneath that smooth jacket of, for lack of a better word, blubber. Basically naked, he did have a kind of web harness strapped around his torso, with a sufficient number of odds and ends attached to it to make it clear that he was a technological being. At first, the pingers had seemed black, but as they came out of the water, it became clear that their skin was dark gray and mottled with patches of lighter gray, shading toward blues and greens. Their bellies were of lighter hue than their backs, and the mottling tended to run up their sides. Ty didn't like to stare, but he couldn't help it. Nothing was visible between their legs save a system of concentric folds within which, Ty assumed, a fairly normal set of genitalia must be hiding, perhaps just awaiting a suitable invitation to present themselves. They were drawing close enough now that their faces could be looked at. The underlying skulls probably looked the same as those of rootstock humans, but eyes, ears, and nostrils were guarded by a system of muscled flaps that were always in some amount of motion. Sonar Taxlaw's earlier remark about breeding wolves into poodles had been a bit indelicate, but the analogy held up. These people were to more ordinary humans as bulldogs were to hounds. All the same stuff was there. You just had to look for it a little harder. Ty turned back to look at Einstein and Sonar. Understandably, they had eyes only for the approaching pingers. Einstein, he said. Then louder. Einstein! Startled, Einstein nearly fell into the water, then focused on Ty. Do you want it? He mouthed, nodding at the rectangle gripped in his hands. No, Ty said. It has to be a child of Ivy. Now? Now. Einstein gripped the thing's bottom corners in his hands and held it up above his head so that the approaching visitors could get a clear view of it. It was a picture, blown up to about half a meter square. Any spacer would recognize it as an iconic image from the epic. It was the last photograph that Ivy's fiancé, Cal Blankenship, had texted to her from the conning tower of his submarine moments before closing the hatch and diving to escape from the opening salvo of the hard rain. The image was dominated by two concentric circles, in the middle distance, the aperture of the open hatch, framing a disk of sky already split in two by the fiery trace of a bolide. Surrounding that, much closer to the camera, the engagement ring that he had just removed from his finger. The question was whether Cal's descendants would recognize it. The lead pinger's face unfolded a little, his gray eyes seeming to become larger, his ears blooming from mere slits into something more resembling normal human ears, except smaller and sleeker. He stopped trudging in knee-deep water. The other two drew abreast of him. All three were gazing up at the picture held aloft by the shivering Ivan. Ty's ears were tickled by high-pitched vocalizations that were almost recognizable as English words. The pingers were talking to one another, turning their heads to exchange remarks, pointing at the picture, gesticulating broadly. Of course, people who spent a lot of time underwater would become good at talking with their hands. The female pinger said something emphatic, getting the attention of the other two. Ty couldn't understand the words, but the tone and the body language were emphatic. "Shut up. Listen. I know what this is." She held her left hand in front of her body. The palm was elongated, the fingers were stubby, and when she spread them apart, slightly webbed. With her right hand, she enclosed the ring finger of the left and pantomimed sliding a ring off. She held the imaginary ring aloft, then brought her left hand up to her face and twitched her index finger once, pretending to take a picture. Kathree felt herself, as she watched all of this, sliding down the slope on her ass in a semi-controlled manner, almost afraid that she might scare the pingers away with a sudden movement. Bard had reached the lower camp quicker and laid Sergeant Major Yore out on a sleeping bag, where Hope was attending to him, already hooking up an intravenous tube. Kathree passed by Bellet, who was straddling the helpless red Neoander, putting huge plastic ties on his ankles and wrists. She made it down to the beach, keeping well clear of Cantabrigia V, who was speaking into a camera, and Arjun, who was just watching and mumbling into his VARP. Several more pingers had waded up into the shallows. One of them, a male strapped with more gear than the others, had approached Ty and seemed to be trying to communicate with him. Ty was grinning, but he kept cupping a hand around his ear and shaking his head. The pinger reached out, gently took Ty's wrist, and plucked at the black stuff of his dry suit. Ty responded by mimicking the same gesture on the slick skin of the pinger's arm. Both of them laughed. The pinger's teeth were white, and they were sharp. The first three pingers had come ashore on the islet and were inspecting the photograph, which Einstein was holding now in front of his chest, part invitation and part shield. Sonar Tax Law, not so encumbered, faced off uncertainly against the female pinger, who suddenly stepped forward and embraced her. On the beach, Cantabrigia V exchanged a satisfied look with Issa Arjun and glanced toward the sky. Epilogue. Cal sent more than one photo to Eve Ivy during the weeks leading up to the hard rain, said Issa Arjun. A total of 17, including that one. He nodded at the picture. Somewhat the worse for wear, it was leaning against the inner wall of Ark Darwin's fuselage at the end of the table where he and Ty were eating lunch. He and Ty and Deep. Deep was the pinger who had approached Ty and befriended him with a nonverbal joke about his dry suit. He was seated a couple of chairs away at the same table. It wasn't really clear whether he thought of himself as part of this conversation. "Can he understand what I'm saying?" Arjun asked. "He's getting better. We sound like tuba music to them." "Is his name really what you say it is?" "It's the closest I can get to pronouncing it," Ty said, "and he answers to it." Deep had been tearing into a raw fish fillet, served on a platter with some seaweed garnishes. He seemed then to realize that he was being talked about, and tensed up in a way that seemed very human. At a loss for words, he grabbed his cup of cider and raised it to them. They raised theirs in return, and all drank. "I think he's some kind of technician or scientist,"
Ty said. All that stuff in his harness.
Yes, Arjun said, eyeing the pinger curiously. Optics, electronics. They preserved more technology than the diggers were able to.
They had more space, Ty pointed out, and they could scavenge whatever sank to the bottom.
He turned his attention back to Arjun. Anyway, you were saying about the 17 photos?
Yes, most of them were of a type referred to in those days as selfies. Now, technically, this was a criminal violation of military secrecy. Very strange, given that Cal was otherwise so attentive to duty.
Yes, said Ty, casting his mind back to scenes from the epic. I remember Eve Ivy agonizing about that when Eve Julia ordered Cal to nuke Venezuela.
That's a perfect example. So this lapse, if that's what it was, has attracted some attention from scholars. All 17 of the photos were eventually recovered from Ivy's phone. An obscure sub-sub-sub-discipline of historical scholarship grew up around them.
The kind of thing only Ivans would care about, said Ty.
Cloistered in some library on Stromness.
Exactly. Ark Darwin was still riding at anchor outside the cove, and its fuselage was still flooded. This made it a perfect setting for what was happening now, a diplomatic conference between the pingers and a delegation of important blue officials who had been pod-dropped straight from Greenwich a few hours after the conclusion of the battle above the beach. Einstein, Sonar Taxlaw, and all the other blues had evacuated the cove and gone aboard the Ark. Bellet had been the last to depart. Before climbing into the waiting boat, he had freed the captured Neoander and left him with enough provisions to keep him in good stead until he could be rescued by his own people. And his own people had shown up in force a few hours later. But according to the deal they themselves had struck with the diggers, their claim was to the land surface only. And Ark Darwin wasn't on the land. So, a growing red military encampment was spreading around the shore of the cove, facing their blue counterparts across a few hundred meters of salt water. The Ark's flooded hull was chilly and obliged the blue diplomats to dress warmly. Ty, Deep, and Arjun were in a dry space higher up and farther forward, a sort of half-exposed mezzanine, where folding tables and chairs had been set up to act as a mess hall for the growing complement of blue personnel, as well as any pingers who felt like wading up the ramp. They were eating hot soup and quaffing a funky but quite palatable cider from the northern slope of Antimer.
Now, said Arjun, enjoying, as only an Ivan could, the opportunity to wax professional, what you must be wondering about these people is how the hell they survived. With only one submarine.
Arjun nodded.
It turns out that if you look at the work of those scholars I mentioned, the most recent of whom died 2 centuries ago, there are clues.
But if the selfies were taken before the hard rain even began, Ty protested,
how could there be clues as to what happened after?
I mean clues that Cal went out of his way to plant in the background of the photos. Clues intended for Ivy's eyes only. Hints that he had more of a chance than one might imagine.
Go on.
Ty sat back and reached for his cup of cider.
We know all about the Cloud Ark program because it's where we came from. It is our history. We have all of the records in our archives. Well, what Cal was hinting at with these photos is that there was another program, perhaps as large, that we never heard about.
A program to keep people alive under the sea? Ty asked.
Exactly. There are, in the background of these photos, detailed bathymetric charts of some of the deepest undersea canyons in the world's oceans. There are documents, binders on a shelf, whose titles suggest that they are about such preparations. Other clues as well. It's all public research. I'll send you the information if you want it.
Okay, Ty said. Just to be cordial. He knew that he would never read those research papers. But the bottom line is that Deep's people, he nodded at their table mate, didn't survive just because Cal got lucky.
They have an epic of their own that, for all we know, might compare to ours, Arjun said.
Sonar and Einstein had been making their way down the food service line and now approached, eyeing the two vacant seats at the table.
Arjun took this as his cue to excuse himself. Deep said goodbye to him with a courteous bob of the head. Within moments, Ty and his pinger friend had been joined by the young Ivan and the psych. For a minute or two, the new arrivals did nothing but eat ravenously, the only conversation being Sonar asking the names and origins of the various foods, all new to her, on her tray. Ty handled those inquiries so that Einstein could be left free to stuff his face. After a while, this became a source of amusement even to Sonar Taxlaw, who just watched the boy eat, and transferred some of her food to his tray when he began to run low.
"Sometime, you'll have to tell me what it's like," Ty remarked.
"What?" Einstein began before food got in the way.
"What's like?" Sonar said, completing his sentence.
"Finding someone so completely, the way you two did."
"That's never happened to you?" Einstein asked. He wasn't being rude. It had simply never occurred to him that he could have had experiences of which Tyora Tom Lake knew nothing.
"No, it's never happened to me."
Einstein had begun to approach the point of satiation. He sat back in his chair and cast his gaze over the wreckage of his lunch, looking for any morsels that deserved more attention.
"I have a question for you," he said.
"Fancy that," Ty returned.
"What's the purpose? People keep mentioning it."
"I wish I knew."
"Very funny, but you know what I'm talking about. Roscoe Sayur mentioned it. Cantabrigia 5 mentioned it. Purpose, with a capital P."
"My answer remains the same," Ty said. "No one has ever told me. I have to make guesses based on what I see from people who act like they know what it is."
"People like the owners of your bar?"
"Evidently."
"And what is your guess?" Sensing another pair of eyes on him, Ty glanced over toward Deep, who was chewing vigorously, trying to reduce a stubborn wad of seaweed to submission. But he seemed to be following the conversation. Ty shrugged.
"Humans have always..."
He was about to say deluded themselves, but didn't want to make a poor impression on Deep.
"Preferred to believe that there was a purpose to the universe. Until the moon blew up, they had theories. After Zero, the theories all seemed kind of stupid. Fairy tales for coddled children. No one thought about the big picture for a few thousand years. We were all scrambling to survive. Like ants when their nest has been destroyed. On those rare occasions when we thought about the big picture, it wasn't really that big. Red versus blue or what have you. There was surprisingly little thinking about the agent. Where it came from. Whether it was natural or artificial. Or even divine."
Einstein, the psych, and Deep were all nodding, as if to say, "Go on, go on." But he had nothing to go on with.
"Some people, some red, some blue, and some ambiguous folks like the owners of my bar, maybe even some of those kind of people," he nodded at Deep, "seem to think they know something."
"Do they?"
asked Sonar Taxlaw.
"I have no idea," said Ty. "But from what I've seen, they're not stupid, even if they are..."
He paused, groping for words.
"Even if they are," Einstein repeated. "What?"
"It's a way. The purpose is a way of saying there's something bigger than this crap we've spent the last week of our lives dealing with."
"Red versus blue crap?"
"Yes. And even though no one is sharing anything with me, yet, I like the feeling of that. People who claim they are motivated by the purpose end up behaving differently, and generally better, than people who serve other masters."
"So it is like believing in God?"
"Maybe, yes. But without the theology, the scripture, the pig-headed certainty."
Einstein and the psych nodded and looked thoughtful, but also, or so it seemed to Ty, a little let down.
Sorry I didn't have an answer to your question, Ty said.
What are you going to do next, now that your seven is disbanded? Asked Sonar.
Go back to my bar.
On Cradle?
On Cradle. Once an astonishing wonder of technological prowess. Now a quaint, outmoded precursor to the vastly superior Gnomon.
I'd like to see it, Sonar said.
We have rooms, apartments where people can stay, around the courtyard in the back.
They must be expensive.
They are free, Ty said.
How do you get one of those free rooms? Einstein asked.
Be it's me. The owners hand them out to people who serve the purpose.
Very important people, then.
Ty shrugged. They can't kill you for asking. You're right about this seven. That's gone. Our Ivan died. You took his place. Einstein cackled nervously.
I'm no replacement for Doc.
You don't have to replace him, not in that sense. But look what you did. You made first contact with these guys. He nodded at Deep. And first contact of another kind with the Diggers.
Both Einstein and Sonar Taxlaw blushed deeply. The Psyche came along and replaced Memmi. That's not a traditional seven. But if we can pry Bellad and Cathree apart, and if we can round up a Julian and a Camite who don't hate each other, we'll have ourselves a nine. The first nine ever assembled.
Ty was just running his mouth, letting the cider talk. Sonar, however, was taking it all seriously.
But only one of the Aiden subraces will be represented, she pointed out.
Bard is plenty.
You should include the other four, Einstein said.
That makes 13, an unlucky number, and a bit of a crowd, frankly.
But the youngsters across the table from him were looking heartrendingly sincere. Ty broke eye contact.
I'll bet I could talk the owners out of a few free rooms for such a momentous occasion.
Are you really going to ask them?
Sonar exclaimed.
Nah. As an ancient saying has it, it's easier to ask forgiveness than permission. You are all welcome at the crow's nest.
Ty looked over at Deep.
Just go easy on the cold baths, man. The plumbing in that place has seen better days, and I'm the only one who knows how to fix it.
We hope you have enjoyed our presentation of Seven Eves by Neal Stephenson, performed by Mary Robinette Kowal and Will Damron, directed by Max Bloomquist and Jerry Maybrook, engineered by Stephen Jacoby. Performance copyright 2015 by Brilliance Audio. All rights reserved. For further information concerning this program or other Brilliance Audio titles, please call the following toll-free number, 1-800-222-3225, or visit our website at www.brillianceaudio.com. No part of this recording may be played for an audience or reproduced in any form. It may not be streamed, downloaded, broadcast, or copied without written permission. Address all inquiries to Brilliance Audio, P.O. Box 887, Grand Haven, Michigan, 49417.